Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Dave Ellis, chair of Rensselaer Environmental Coalition, gives an update about residents' complaints about the Dunn landfill. Then on Reclaiming History, we'll hear part two of Lavonia Mallory's interview with Professor Etta L. Fields Black of Carnegie Mellon University about a Harriet Tubman-led military raid to free enslaved people in South Carolina. After that, Luke Weber brings us voices from a recent Tonko Tuesday rally in which people of Albany United for Safe Energy have been pushing to keep climate change at the top of Representative Tonko's agenda. Then Nithin Pagal speaks with Professor Glenn Chilek from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute about stars and the interstellar medium. And to close out the show, Moses Nagel speaks with teachers at the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs about how they've managed to bring students music instruction while following social distancing and other protocols. But first, here are the headlines. The Gazette reports the incoming Schenectady School Board member Jamaica Miles and several community members on Wednesday suggested that the school board hold off on hiring an interim superintendent until Miles and another new board member are sworn in at the beginning of July. The board appeared to ignore the recommendations and convened to continue their discussion on finding an interim leader for the district. Cases against two protesters who allegedly chalked Schenectady police headquarters, prompting the police department to put temporary fencing around the building's entrance in April, were adjourned in contemplation of a dismissal. Protests concerned the police shooting death of Dante Wright, a 20-year-old Black man in Minnesota. The Gazette reports that Albany Medical Center will pay $90,000 in restitution to seven foreign nurses it was accused of illegally fining for quitting their jobs. The move settles an investigation by the state attorney general's office, which said the hospital forced the nurses it recruited overseas to pay up to $20,000 upon quitting or being fired with cause within 3 years of being hired. Foreign nurses have been recruited to work in the United States for decades. The House voted on Thursday to revoke the authorization it gave in 2002 to invade Iraq, a step that would rein in presidential war-making powers for the first time in a generation, the New York Times reports. The bipartisan action reflected growing determination on Capitol Hill to revisit the broad authority that Congress provided to President George W. Bush following the September 11th attacks, 2001, although measures that successive presidents have used to justify military action around the world. That's it for the headlines. For those of you who want to get their hands in dirt, the Collar City Growers Garden has open gardening hours every week. Everyone is welcome to drop in on Fridays from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. and Sundays from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. The garden is located a few doors down from the Sanctuary for Independent Media at 3337 6th Avenue in Troy, 12181. The Common Council of the City of Rensselaer voted on June 16th to urge the State Department of Environmental Conservation to shut down the Dunn Construction and Debris Landfill next to the Rensselaer Junior Senior High School. Dave Ellis, chair of Rensselaer Environmental Coalition, gives us an update about residents' complaints about the landfill and what the next steps are. I'm Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're joined by Dave Ellis, who is president of the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition. And among other things, they've been very active over the years in trying to get the Dunn Construction and Demolition Debris Landfill in the city of Rensselaer, shut down because of the neighborhood problems it creates. So, Dave, this week the group is out in front of the city council holding a rally. Can you explain what took place at the city council this week?
So we decided to hold a rally of sorts outside of the Rensselaer City Hall prior to the meeting of the Common Council on Wednesday, June 16th. They were going to vote on a resolution calling on the New York State DEC to immediately revoke the operating permit of the Dunn landfill. And that's due in part to all of the negative consequences this landfill has on the Rensselaer community. So the group of Rensselaer Environmental Coalition members, as well as members of the community, rallied at out front in support of Mayor Mike Stammel's resolution to the council.
Now, were the residents allowed to testify before the council? And if so, what were some of the key points that some of the neighbors raised?
Yeah, so there was probably more than a dozen people who signed up to speak to the common council, which began at 6:30 p.m. It was across the boards that the concerns from the community are this dump needs to be closed and this council needs to come and speak out about the impacts this landfill is having on the community. We've been going before the same council since 2017 with our concerns, and we've been told all along that DEC is a responsible agency and there's really nothing that the council can do. At a recent council meeting, I asked the council if they would co-sponsor a resolution. I was told that, you know, it was a waste of paper. I asked what that meant, and they said that creating a resolution would do nothing to help the issue with the landfill. And I said, you know, it doesn't hurt to try, but the council wasn't willing to try. So I went to Mayor Mike Stammel, and he created a resolution. We've been working on it since April with input from the Environmental Coalition. And finally, a resolution was brought to the table and the council decided they would vote on it. So, of course, the concerns from the community were a big part of the meeting last Wednesday.
So what does the state DEC Department of Environmental Conservation been saying about this? I know that they have said that the permit, I guess, is up for renewal next year, will be more starting from the beginning, but are you really, you know, having any sense what DEC is willing to do to help the neighbors?
So DEC is saying that based on all of the concerns from the community, you know, and new potential environmental threats such as the PFAS and Rensselaer now possibly being an environmental justice community based on the latest census data, that DEC will have to undergo a more strenuous process for the Dunn landfill renewal in 2022. They're going to require that there is more public hearings and more public input. So hopefully it'll make the whole process start from ground zero. Dunn will have to submit brand new applications and all kinds of environmental data, and there will be a great deal of public input. So hopefully that will go a long way.
Now, one of the problems with DEC is once, you know, some, you know, polluter has a permit to operate, they seldom, you know, take that permit away. They sort of renew it, you know, whenever it comes up. But I think most people say it was really a dumb idea for the state ever to allow this type of huge landfill, not only to be, you know, right, you know, through a residential neighborhood in terms of the truck traffic, but particularly to be located so close, you know, to a school. Is there any indication that the state sort of willing to say, hey, I'm sorry, we made a mistake first time we gave you the permit. We really can't continue this.
Well, members of the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition met several different times, I believe in 2019, with top officials at the DEC. And they told us off the record that mistakes were made in the past, and they were very sorry. Many of the people who are now with the region for DEC in our area were not part of the original permitting of the Dunn landfill, but they did agree that mistakes were made, and they would take any violations at Dunn seriously and make sure they're addressing these issues, and they told us that they would allow greater public participation. So hopefully, you know, they stay true to those words. There's a new regional director, Tony Luisi. He's a great guy. Whenever we have questions or concerns, he gets back to us right away. So we're hoping that DEC is more transparent with the process.
Now, I remember probably the last public event I did before the COVID shutdown was I covered a press conference you did at the landfill, I guess in March of a year ago. And, you know, there was some report, I believe it may have been about PFOA and the leachate. I don't exactly remember the details, but whatever happened to that particular issue?
Yeah, so we had a big rally out in front of the gate of the Dunn landfill. We had former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Thang speak, I believe Dr. David Carpenter from the UAlbany School of Public Health, and many different community members talking about the environmental threats from the PFAS that was discovered surrounding the Dunn landfill property. The Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility helped REC with testing of three streams surrounding the Dunn landfill property, and those results were sent to an EPA-approved lab, and all the results came back showing high levels of PFAS. Now, DEC was provided those test results and said that REC was fear-mongering, but later they requested that Dunn landfill do their own testing of leachate on the facility, and the leachate results came back even higher. Now, all of a sudden, residents of the community just received this beautiful flyer in the mail from Dunn using the same exact word that DEC did, saying that the information about PFAS was fear-mongering, and they're claiming that there's no PFAS contamination from their facility, even though that results show otherwise.
So where does the review of this permit and the Dunn landfill go forward, you know, from this point?
So hopefully all of the information that we're gathering, we have the support of the Town of East Greenbush Board. They passed a resolution early last year calling on the DEC to revoke the operating permit for Dunn. Now we have the City of Rensselaer Common Council doing the same thing. The outcry from the public, all of the testing data, and the health impacts that we have gathered throughout the years, you know, the records of people's complaints, odor reports, hopefully all of that data will help build a case to allow us to get the public hearings that we deserve and get a fair chance to present to the DEC that this is a serious problem in our community. There was serious lack of oversight when siting this facility next to a pre-existing school, and the impacts are much greater than the corrective actions that the landfill has taken, and this landfill needs to be shut down.
So we have about 90 seconds left, so two-part question. If people want more information, they want to submit comments, how do they do that? And do you guys also work on the bio high tech that's in Rensselaer, another waste project? Can you quickly just say, has anything happened recently with that project?
I have not heard any new developments about BioHiTech. I did hear recently that the company that is planning to bring that facility to Rensselaer is trying to meet with Mayor Mike Stammel again to submit their case to allow them to operate in the city, even though that DEC told them they have to start over again. For more information on both projects, you can visit stopdunn.org, or you can find the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition on Facebook by typing in Rensselaer Environmental Coalition.
And as Governor Cuomo, who, you know, runs DEC, has he ever said anything about the Dunn landfill?
We have been calling publicly for the governor to speak out about this landfill and also calling on him to tell DEC to close the landfill, but we have never publicly heard from the governor about these issues.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I've been talking with Dave Ellis, president of the Rensselaer Environmental Coalition, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Dave Ellis, chair of Rensselaer Environmental Coalition, in conversation with Mark Dunley. To find other coverage by Mark Dunley on the Dunn landfill, visit bediasanctuary.org/stories. Up next on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory speaks with Dr. Etta L. Fields Black, associate professor in the Department of History at Carnegie Mellon University. Professor Fields Black discusses Harriet Tubman freeing more than 700 people during a military raid in South Carolina. This is part two of a multi-part segment.
Working in Beaufort with refugees who are coming off of the plantations and helping them to get settled and helping them, you know, to get rations and helping them to find work and or other ways of making money to feed their families, but to actually go on to plantations. And it's like putting, it's not just going to the zoo and looking at the animals, but you're putting your hand in the lion's mouth.
Correct.
Right? To go on to those plantations to bring people out is something that is just, I still struggle to wrap my head around the enormity of that risk and the enormity of that sacrifice.
The excerpt you just heard is part of my interview with Dr. Etta Fields Black, Stay tuned. Once again, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory. I am honored to have a very special guest on the line with us. Dr. Etta L. Fields Black is the Associate Professor at Carnegie Mellon University in the Department of History. She has written many numerous scholarly studies on transnational history of West African rice farmers, including Deep Roots, Rice Farmers in West Africa and the African Diaspora, and Rice, Global Networks and New Histories. She's also co-produced a symphonic work entitled Unburied, Unmourned, Unmarked, Requiem for Rice with the 3-time Emmy Award-winning classical music composer John Wineglass. Dr. Fields Black has also been a history consultant for the International African American Museum, scheduled to open in Charleston in 2022. She has been a past consultant with the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture's permanent exhibit, Rice Fields of the Low Country. But today we are going to be talking about her upcoming book entitled Cumbie, Harriet Tubman, The Cumbehee River Raid and Black Freedom During the Civil War by Oxford University. Dr. Etta Fields Black, are you there?
I'm here.
So, you know, I keep asking this question is always, you know, being a person who admires, you know, military folks and their willingness. I come from a family of men who have served in the military and distant cousins, female cousins. Mm-hmm. This woman, Harriet, did she carry a gun? Was she armed when she snuck behind enemy lines with these scouts?
That I don't know. The sources do not tell us that. Now, I know that in the woodcut, Harriet is carrying a knapsack and that there are oral traditions that she kept a pistol in the knapsack. Mm-hmm. There are accounts of Tubman on the plantations and sort of not so much on the plantations, but leaving the plantations in the raid and literally running with enslaved people and helping enslaved people to carry things, mainly pigs and small children and other, you know, their very meager belongings, but things that they tried to bring with them. In those accounts, there's not an account, there's not a mention of Tubman carrying a knapsack. The sources don't reveal that she carried a gun or a knapsack that may have had a gun in it. And quite honestly, historical sources don't tell us everything. We know that she was on the boat. Okay. We know she was on the plantation. We know that she was coming from the plantation. She gives a very rich description of that. Have a good idea of what happened during the raid, but that detail of whether or not she was carrying a gun, whether or not she was armed, either carrying her own gun, which we know she had, or carrying a pistol or a rifle or something that was issued by the U.S. Army, that we don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what do you know about the raid itself?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, early in the morning, they're called gunboats, but they're not really gunboats. This is how enslaved and formerly enslaved people who were in the region called them. They called them Yankee gunboats. So that's what I'm going to call them for the moment. These 4 Yankee gunboats left Beaufort, South Carolina, and they left and they arrived before daybreak. So just about, the sun is just about to come up. And the enslaved laborers were already in the rice fields. They were already in the fields hoeing rice. And they saw the boats coming up the river. They ran to the boats. We know from one of the planters that he was asleep in his bed. And the enslaved driver bursts into his bedroom. He says it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. He's in bed asleep and tells him that the Yankees are coming. They're coming up the river. They're almost right outside the house. And so he pulls on, I assume, a pair of pants and runs outside and tells the driver to go get the field hands. He's going to go get the house servants. They should all hide in the woods. But the enslaved people see the gunboats coming up and they run for the boat. And so Tubman describes this just scene of people running for their lives, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And some people, we can assume, went back to the slave quarters to get things or to get people or to get animals that they wanted to take with them, you know, all they owned in the world. And whether they went back to the quarters or not, they ran straight for the boat. And they got on the boats, and there were so many people. And one of the boats ran aground before they got up the river, so they only had three boats. There were so many people, they couldn't take everybody. And they couldn't take the stuff, you know, the small, meager possessions that people wanted to bring with them. And so they had to leave it behind. And they got on the boats and they sailed back to Beaufort. With approximately, Tubman says, 756 people. Colonel Montgomery says 730-something, maybe 31. Either way, it's over 700. Either way, it's over 725, I would say. And they sail back to Beaufort. Yeah. And they're taken to a church. The men are stripped and examined, and they're enlisted in the military, the men.
How significant is it that she was freeing slaves? Like, I mean, we often think about, we all know the story of Harriet Tubman. She's this great Underground Railroad conductor. She brings so many people to freedom. But slaves were property. Was not just to free slaves, quote unquote, but to capture resources from the enemy.
Yeah, it was very significant. It was very, very significant. And I'll say two things. On the one hand, in terms of Harriet Tubman, she risked her life to free other people time and time and time and time again. Right. Going on to plantations in the region of Dorchester County to bring people out to freedom. Many of them were friends, many of them were family members, many of them were community members, people who had, with whom she had some relationship. For her to go to the Deep South, for her to go into the belly of the beast, to leave freedom in Philadelphia, Boston, or even in Canada after the fugitive slave law becomes law in 1850. For her to go into the belly of the beast and risk her life to help people she doesn't know is just mind-boggling.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe it. We are out of time. To my listeners, tune in again. I will continue my discussion with Dr. Etta L. Fields Black, associate professor at Carnegie Mellon, who's working on her upcoming book entitled Cumbie, Harriet Tubman, The Cumbahee River Raid, and Black Freedom During the Civil War, by Oxford University.
That was Lavonia Mallory speaking with Dr. Etta L. Fields Black, author of the upcoming book, Cumbie, Harriet Tubman, The Cumbie River Raid, and Black Freedom During the Civil War. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's @mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. Tunco Tuesdays continued to gain momentum this Tuesday as Eric Weltman from Food and Water Watch made an appearance in support of the work that Sandy Stubig, along with People of Albany United for Safe Energy, or PAWS, have been doing to keep climate change at the top of Representative Paul Tonko's agenda. Luke Weber interviews people at the event.
Hello, this is Lucas Weber, and I'm interviewing Sandy
Stubing.
And Sandy, you are one of the major players in this event. Last week you were here. Can you just tell me a little bit about what has happened from last week to this week?
So Tonko Tuesdays is taking place every Tuesday at noon in front of Congressman Tonko's office at 19 Dove Street at noon. And so if any of the listeners would care to join us, we would love to have you. Now, last week, we joined up with Extinction Rebellion of the Capital Region, and we supported them in their efforts to bring attention to the pipelines. And so half of the rally took place here at 19 Dove Street, and half of it took place down in the front of Chase Bank, which subsidizes these pipelines. We had a wonderful march down Washington and State Streets. We chanted all the way. We got some honks. It was a very good rally.
That was Sandy Stubing, an activist and organizer for People of Albany at United for Safe Energy, giving us a recap of what happened last week at Tonko Tuesdays. To learn more about last week's Tonko Tuesday, visit Media Sanctuary on SoundCloud to find past segments of Tonko Tuesdays.
Today was another very good rally. We had Eric Weltman from Food and Water Watch come up from Brooklyn to talk to us about the Impolluter Welfare Act, which is about fossil fuel subsidies that our government and Congressman Tonko still supports.
This is Eric Weltman from Brooklyn.
My name is Eric Weltman. I'm a New York-based organizer with Food and Water Watch.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your organization?
Sure. Food and Water Watch is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to oppose corporate control and abuse of our most vital resources, the water we drink, the food we eat, the climate we rely on, and to ensure that government fulfills its obligation to protect our health, communities, and environment.
And to listeners on the radio that don't know much about this subject and maybe would want to get involved, what would you tell them?
I would encourage folks to check out PAWS, which is an affiliate, a local affiliate of 350.org, or they can visit the Food and Water Watch website, foodandwaterwatch.org. I work out of an office that we have in Brooklyn, and again, we work with activists and allies across the state from Long Island to Buffalo and just about everywhere in between. And we're glad to work with any of your listeners. If they have any questions or need more information, hop on the internet and give us a ring.
Thank you. And as we're wrapping up here, do you have any last words for people on the radio?
Well, if you happen to be a constituent of Representative Tonko, please call him, email, visit, write, and urge him to be a real climate champion and co-sponsor the End Polluter Welfare Act.
Thank you for your time. Hello, this is Luke from the Sanctuary of Independent Media. What is your name?
This is Grace Nichols.
Grace, why are you here today at Tonko Tuesday?
Because I feel very strongly that we're at a critical moment in U.S. and actually global history. And this critical moment is when we finally have a president in the White House who could pass, and in a legislature that could pass, good climate legislation, which is sorely needed, the U.S. being a leading climate criminal in the world at large, and New York State actually being leading in the United States as a climate criminal. And so Tonko is positioned on a committee that would allow him to make climate legislation real. And instead, he's chosen to back a bill that misdefines clean energy as things like garbage incineration, nuclear power, natural gas, and a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, that's not clean energy. We all know it. It's way too late in the game for us to be having this kind of conversation. We need to cut emissions now. We need offshore wind. We need a lot of it. We are so far behind Europe. So Tonko knows better. He's a tech guy. He has a little more faith in and perhaps a little more funding from fossil fuels than the rest of us. But, you know, even he knows better. And we're appealing to his better nature and his good education to say, Tonko, get it together, write a good bill, and we'll support it all the way.
Thank you. Okay, so to the person that just randomly switched on to the Sanctuary for Independent Media Radio and doesn't know much about this, what would you say to them in terms of getting people involved?
For some reason, Americans are not yet acting like over 100,000 New Yorkers are going to die in the first sea level rise. I don't know why, but it's got to change.
Do you have any other words for people listening on the radio?
Please join us in the streets. Please connect with PAWS, People of Albany, United for Safe Energy. We've got a great Facebook page. We've got a great website at pawsenergy.org, and we have meetings. There's a general membership meeting once a month at the end of Thursday of the month. If you write us, we'll give you all the links. We want you to come. We need people. This is an emergency.
Thank you. And let's say I am someone who doesn't really know a lot about what's going on, and I want to help, but I'm not 100% fully on the movement, vocal, I'm kind of quiet. Like, what can I do?
There's a lot of things you can do, and one is to connect with Food and Water Watch, which is constantly sending around petitions and things that you can get involved with. There's making phone calls to Cuomo and Biden. You can never call enough. But there's also, you can write me, Grace Nichols, at mtnsbluegreen@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to send you literature so you get it about what's going on. There's a lot of lies out there. It's hard to figure out what's true, but some things are true. And the United Nations, the International Energy Agency, the World Health Organization. There's a lot of reputable bodies who can tell you what's happening with climate change. So just give me a write.
The word is urgency. Can you talk to me about that word and what we're doing today?
Action is the antidote to despair. The sense of urgency is tough to absorb. Your body gets adrenaline going, you feel terrible, you want to jump up and down, and you don't want to do. That's when you have to get active, because the fact is, it is urgent, and the fact is, your adrenaline should be going, and the fact is, you have to act.
Thank you. While gathered on the street corner outside Tonko's office, a man from Iran started speaking to me about the lack of freedom of speech in Iran. He told me that the people's voices are never heard by the government, and they feel powerless. He reminded all of us at the protest that we are fortunate to have the ability and right to express our opinions and show disagreement to our government officials.
Yeah, you know, we needed this universe for next generation, for my kids, for my grandson. If, you know, I want to say something to you. If the temperature of your body increases what degree you have a favor, but you think about if the temperature of the world increased 2 degrees. You know, my earth is have a favor. Thank you.
If you would like to get involved with Tonko Tuesdays, please email sandysteubing@ssteub@gmail.com. To hear past coverage of Tonko Tuesdays, you can visit the Sanctuary for Independent Media on SoundCloud. The name is Media Sanctuary. And of course, please join the growing movement by joining the protest outside Paul Tonko's office every Tuesday at noon this summer.
We'll be back,
Tonko!
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 We'll be back,
Tonko! That was HMM's Luke Weber bringing us voices from a recent Tonko Tuesday event. He will continue to cover Tonko Tuesdays and the discussion around climate solutions in the coming weeks. Now we have our premiere episode in a series on physics called The Dark Side of Physics, with Nitalin Pogal, who speaks with Professor Glenn Cholek from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute about stars and the interstellar medium.
Hello, my name is Nitalin Pogal. Welcome to Dark Side of Physics.
I am Glenn Cholek, and I am a lecturer in physics in the Department of Physics, Applied Physics and Astronomy of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York.
Thank you, Professor Cholek, for joining us. So, Professor, let's, start about, what do you do and what research are you on currently?
Well, I am a theoretical astrophysicist, and my particular branch of research deals with how stars form from the gas and dust in the interstellar medium. So in our Milky Way galaxy and other galaxies, there are great clouds of gas and dust. We can see them because they either block the light from our telescopes or they emit light that can be seen in certain telescopes. And these are actual clouds out in space, and they are a very low density, which means they're like vacuum. You and I couldn't breathe out there, but they contain a lot of matter. And the gas and dust there accumulate through the action of gravity and form stars. And we know that because we can see these clouds and look into them. And we see very young stars in the process of being formed, or very young stars that have just turned on that are also in the process of making, of having planets form. So basically we can see snapshots of how our own solar system would have looked about 4.5 billion years ago. And so my research is involved with various aspects of how the stars form from that gas and dust from these interstellar clouds.
So what aspects do you study about?
Well, I look at what's happening at the early stages of the star formation process. And so basically I apply the laws of physics. So the sort of physics that you might learn in high school or college with Newton's laws of motion and things like that. And so we can write down the equations of that we believe would govern the physics of the star formation process. Although they can't be solved using pencil and paper. Instead, we have to make approximations to these equations using the physics that we know, that we can test in laboratory or by other means. And we apply those equations to the environment that we think these stars are forming in. And from that, we try to develop models that can make predictions as to how star formation would begin. And so I have applied the effects of interstellar magnetic fields to this process, the gas and dust. And so there's a word for this. We call it plasma physics and magnetohydrodynamics, big words. But basically, we just take Newton's second laws or his equations of physics, and we apply them to these environments. And so we do that numerically. We make approximate equations that we give to computers. And we let the computers do the calculations of those approximate equations, and then we interpret them. And then we try to provide observers, people who look through telescopes, either optical or radio telescopes, we make predictions on what they might see if our models were correct. And so then what observational astronomers do is they make the observations to see whether there is any agreement or do these models seem to be in accordance with what they actually see. And so that's why I say I'm a theorist. So I provide these theoretical models, and the equivalent experimentalists or observers, the astronomers, they look and they tell you whether they see things that might be in agreement or things that might not, which may mean that maybe our equations don't have all the right physics, or maybe we aren't starting from the right place. Maybe we should need to reconsider things. Basically, we try to come up with as realistic models as we think that we can solve, because some equations, even with the help of computers, can't be solved in the time that you would like to provide these answers.
So you were talking about that there were clouds of matter, of dust, which are floating around in the universe. What is the significance of it?
Well, they make the stars. And the leftover stuff from when the star forms, they make things, they have a disk of matter around them. Some people refer to that as protostellar disks or protoplanetary disks, because that matter in there can accumulate and form planets. And planets, are we know, are crucial for life, because you and I happen to live on a planet. Also, when the Big Bang occurred, the early formation of the universe, the matter that was formed is mainly hydrogen and helium. But you and I are made out of other things like carbon and magnesium, potassium, and oxygen. And early generations of stars blew up and made those elements that later got incorporated into a generation of stars, such as the generation from which our sun formed. And so you and I are composed of elements that were created from these stars that formed out of the interstellar gas, and also the interstellar dust, which also, of course, made the planet Earth, but also then water was created in these molecular clouds. We know that because we can see the spectral signature of water in these interstellar clouds. There's oceans of it out there, but it's not fluid. It's all gaseous. But it got accumulated into the Earth, in which thing can form liquid water. And of course, us. There's a song by Joni Mitchell called Woodstock. It was covered by Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young called Woodstock. And the refrain of that is, we are stardust, we are golden, we are billion-year-old carbon. She must have known a little bit of astronomy. So that gas and dust ultimately formed our planet. Of course, it formed the sun first, and that's good too, because the sun allows us to live on the surface of the Earth and makes things nice and warm. But it also, that gas and dust got incorporated into us. And so all the carbon in our bodies, the water in our body, came from out there. So I can't think of a more profound influence than that.
So you were talking about how the interstellar dust, the interstellar medium, can create both stars and planets. But obviously, how do they vary? How does the process vary? Because obviously they have to take two different processes, or else Earth could have technically been a star if, say, the conditions and the process in which it happened was right.
Right. Although an underlying overall theme of this would have been gravity. Gravity likes to bring things together. You know, on the surface of the Earth, we throw something up, something comes down. You know, what goes up must come down. If you get a lot of matter, you get a lot of gravity. And so what first would have happened in these clouds is there would have been some region where there would have been enough matter close enough to each other, the gravity would have taken over and would have formed a star. And that star then would have became dense enough for it would have turned on. It would have started actually doing nuclear fusion, something we can't do on the surface of the Earth yet, but we're trying. Well, we can do it through H-bombs, but that's not a good thing. But it does its nuclear fusion. It turned on, and suddenly light appeared. And there was still leftover
and
stuff.
God said, let there be light.
That's very, of course, the book of Genesis was very, very poetic and also very apt in this instance. And so, yes, the star would have turned on, and there would have been some matter that wouldn't have accumulated. But there would have been like a thick disk of material, and we call this a protostellar disk. And the dust in there could have, because the particles collide, and eventually they will over time, they could have stuck together. And then they could have made larger dust or little nuggets that we call planetesimals. And these planetesimals then, over time, could have accumulated and stuck together. So the sun's turning on and getting nice sun-like. And these other objects could have stuck together to form rocky bodies. And those rocky bodies could have stuck together to form planets. So it's another process that would have occurred while a sun itself, our sun, say, for instance, was in the process of turning on and going into what we call its normal sequence of evolution to become a star that we understand and an accompanying disk of planets. And that may be the reason why, because stars form and then this planet forming process takes place soon afterward. That might be the reason why nowadays we see so many planets around the stars, because the more we look, we find more and more planets around the stars. And so they're intimately related, although, as you noted, a star becomes a star and a planet becomes a planet, mainly because a star has more gravity, and so it can hold itself together and turn on and burn and fuse, whereas a planet just doesn't get that much gravity. It can stick things together, but it never makes things dense enough to go boom, turn on. Jupiter, if it was about 100 times bigger, Jupiter could have become a star. So sometimes we refer to planets like Jupiter, large gaseous giants, as failed stars.
That was Madeline Pogal speaking with Professor Glenn Selleck from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute for the series The Dark Side of Physics, and that was its inaugural episode. Finally, this school year has been unique in many ways. Many young musicians were not allowed to sing or practice band and orchestra in the usual way. Teachers scrambled to find different ways to bring students music instruction while following social distancing and other protocols. Moses Nagel learned about one unusual approach at the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs.
Here's the scene. About 24 teenagers sit in chairs in a parking lot. They wear matching red t-shirts, masks, and their chairs are evenly spaced apart. As the camera zooms around them, they clap, stomp, and slap their thighs and chest in perfect unison. What is happening? Well, this is music class at the Waldorf School of Saratoga. Katie Hooper is the music teacher who designed this unusual curriculum.
Well, this is something called body percussion. And as soon as I realized that we were not going to be able to sing safely during COVID, this was what I came up with as the alternative. We also had to eliminate our orchestra program. So we wanted to have the students involved in something musical over the course of the year. And it seemed to me a perfect combination of both music and movement during what was likely to be a fairly stressful year of trying to learn with masks on every other subject, and something that we could do safely using masks and sitting 6 feet apart. So that's where it came from. I'm not a dancer, really. I'm a classical pianist. So I found them online. I happened upon a couple of groups in Spain that actually put up tutorials of how to do body percussion. And one of the first pieces we learned was a folk song, Bring Me Little Water, Sylvie. And that was presented online with a tutorial of how to do the exact body percussion motions with the singing. And that sort of got me started. And then, you know, it's like anything else, you start digging into what's on YouTube and you can find a lot of amazing things. And I just tried to choose the pieces that I thought we could learn. It was very difficult. If I didn't find a piece that had tutorials where they actually broke it down and the teacher was saying, okay, this is how you do it. And here it is really slowly. And here it is up to tempo. When I found ones that were just performances, I learned to play them at 50% speed and constantly stopped and went back and back and back. You know, did they stamp with their left foot or did they stamp with their right foot? And I also worked out kind of a shorthand. I wrote out the timing. So one piece was in 12/8 time. I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I spread that out on a piece of paper, and then 1 is right stamp, and 2 is, you know, right hand to your chest, and 3 is left snap or whatever. So I had like a code at the top of each section. So that particular piece in 12/8 had, I think, 9 sections. So 9 different patterns to learn. So I set up my code for the beginning. TH is thigh, ST is stamp, you know, SN is snap, etc. And then with each new section, I had code that I had to add, you know, so maybe in B2, you know, we had to do what I called a pizza slap. So I would describe for myself what a pizza slap was, but then that was just PZSL.
Rylan is a 9th grader at the school. I asked him about learning the unusual terminology Mrs. Hooper developed.
We got used to her calling them those things because, I mean, that's the only thing that they were referred to as.
What's a pizza slap?
It was in a piece that we started working on. So we were sitting down for this part, and we were using both of our hands to sort of slap our thighs, and then there was one point where we would have to put one of our hands face up and then hit it from the bottom and send it up in the air a bit. You sort of hit one hand up in the air with the other hand, and I guess you called it a pizza slap because I guess it's similar to if you see someone, like, throw up a pizza in the air when it's still the dough in, like, movies and stuff.
Bring me little water, Sylvie. Bring me little water now. Bring me little water.
I saw in the Bring Me Little Water, Sylvie, you did have singing.
Those are three girls from the same family. So I borrowed a seventh grader from the lower school, and then the eighth grade was in our high school this year, and the 10th grader. So these three girls are all in the same family. And as soon as I found out that I wasn't going to be able, I was hoping I could use high school students to sing and just kind of separate them out, but that was nixed immediately. Just no singing, period. And the same way when I did the waltz, the Shostakovich waltz. I was hoping to do that with a little string ensemble, but the string ensemble crossed over from 11th and 12th into 9th and 10th, and I wasn't allowed to put those kids in the same room. So I scratched that and used a recording. I would have loved to have done it with students playing, and they were enthusiastic, but I didn't have a full string quartet in either cohort. So yeah, with the singing, I worked with those three girls after school for many, many sessions until they learned the harmony. I found sheet music for that piece in four-part harmony, and I adjusted it to three-part harmony for it would fit their voices. And we worked a long time before they were able to learn it, but it came out beautifully.
Every little once in a while.
Unlike choral music, where you can have students in the chorus, and at our school, everybody has to be in chorus. That's not an elective. You know, even as a choral teacher, I can't always tell if John or Mary or Susie is actually singing. Their mouths could be moving, but I mean, I've got all the voices together and I've got a lot going on. With body percussion, you don't have a choice. You're, especially in COVID, you're 6 feet apart. And if you're not clapping and stamping and standing up and sitting back down with everybody else, you look kind of ridiculous, right? So Everybody participated. And some of the eighth graders were just as good as the 12th graders. It wasn't like you had wonderful singers and not such great singers. Everybody was starting from scratch. And I never had any complaints, even though they didn't exactly say at the end, oh, this was wonderful. We loved doing this. Throughout the year, I had different students come to me and saying, I really like doing body percussion. This is so much fun. So, you know, and when I was teaching them, I never had the sense that there was anybody sitting there feeling grumpy about it. Some of the kids were a little shy about it, and I had to really encourage them to, you know, when they had to do a gesture that had both hands going straight up in the air, I had to work on that pretty hard because they would go up with bent elbows instead of, you know, with their arms stretched, right? But again, it's a leveler. Everybody can do that. Everybody can stretch their hands out, right? They just have to be courageous.
Ryland told me how the students got the confidence to perform these pieces courageously.
When we would first start learning a piece, it would be confusing because, you know, we would have no idea what we were supposed to do. But then eventually it sort of got, like, very easy to do the pieces. I mean, we worked on the pieces so much that, like, when we were about to perform a piece, when we, like, really had it, it was actually very easy because a lot of it was just muscle memory. So, not all of us, but a lot of us could sort of just do it without really thinking. And so it got very easy towards the end.
And how is this different for you from the chorus?
I guess, well, the obvious difference is that you're not actually singing. And I feel like body percussion is Well, it's more, I guess, exercise maybe because you're moving your body. I wouldn't really say it's more easy or more difficult than singing, but the process of, like, learning it is sort of similar because you'll work on, like, one part at a time until you get that part, and you'll work on, then you'll work on other parts, and then you'll put the whole thing together. So it is fairly similar, just one you're singing, the other year. Yeah.
Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
That was Moses Nagel speaking with teachers at the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs on their unique approach to music instruction during the pandemic. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer is Sina Bazila-Hickey. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7.07 p.m. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.